Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. This past week, the Jack Kemp Foundation hosted a forum in Columbia, South Carolina for Republican presidential candidates and other conservative leaders to discuss their ideas for fighting poverty. The half-day event was hosted by Speaker Paul Ryan and moderated by Senator Tim Scott. To discuss the ideas raised during the forum, we're joined by Robert Doerr, resident fellow in poverty studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Just to start off with getting both of your takes, the event was touted as a day that was going to produce or unveil big ideas with regard to fighting poverty, the conservative set of big ideas in this space. Did the forum go as you expected? Did it produce big ideas? Robert Doerr, I want to start with you.
Sure. First of all, I was there, so it was an exciting event for someone like me who's worked in poverty programs for 15 years in New York State and New York City to have an entire, actually, day devoted to just poverty and opportunity issues and have the presidential candidates take center stage on just this issue. So it was substantive. It was lengthy. It was at times eloquent. Sometimes, like all campaigns, it was also had its lower moments. But there were some big ideas. I mean, there are, you know, Republicans like to push programs down to states. They like smaller government. They like to devolve the responsibilities of programs to states. So we talked about that. It was great to hear Speaker Ryan use the phrase work supports, which is a phrase that I've used for years in promoting those programs that shore up low wages and make them go further and often are forms of government assistance. There was a general sort of acceptance of government as having a role in helping poor struggling Americans, and for Republicans, that's something they don't often talk about, and it was great to hear them talk about it. So I did think it was substantive, and there were some big ideas, but I also need to caution that in that format and in that situation with candidates, and even though they had much longer time to answer questions, you're not going to get, you know, this deep dive into, you know, marginal tax rates, although they talked about that too.
Yeah, I wasn't there. I spent the day at the volleyball tournament where my 14-year-old took gold.
Congrats to her.
For the team. Good. So go United.
Congratulations.
That's the name of their volleyball team. Right. So my day was well spent, I thought, as well. it was great to hear Robert hold forth on those ideas in no small part because, A, it really is important for both parties to be talking about this. And I think if I can be a touch partisan for a second, and in fact, here I'm really citing Paul Ryan himself. I think oftentimes Republicans have been missing in action on the real substantive discussion about poverty, oftentimes suggesting that if poor people just wanted to, they could get themselves out of poverty, and it's kind of just a personal thing. And as Robert very correctly, and I think, you know, and somewhat upliftingly from my perspective, said there is a role for work supports, which I have actually are a critical part of our anti-poverty approach. Acceptance of the role of government, those are key. There were things that I heard that I disagreed with, some quite strongly. The idea of devolving certain parts of the safety net down to states is, in my view, very risky, in no small part, and I know we'll get into this, because I'm afraid that it would really whack the heck out of the counter-cyclical dimensions of the safety net, which means the ability to really respond to recessions, as we saw in the last downturn. My read of the evidence, and I'm sure we'll have time to debate this, is that programs that have been block granted don't have that counter-cyclical response function relative to ones that remain at the federal level. But generally speaking, I like the fact that the those folks are at the table and what they're talking about.
And we'll have plenty of time to get into the specifics of some of the policies that were discussed and some of which you've just brought up. But before we get into the nuts and bolts of policies, I just want to ask just to kind of plant us in present day. It's not that long since Mitt Romney's fatally radioactive comments about the 47%, right? That isn't so far behind us in the rearview mirror. How did we get to where we are, where the discussion of poverty is happening on the conservative side of the aisle in this way? Robert Doerr.
Well, I think there are two reasons for that. I think that there is a little bit of regret about the way that that was portrayed the Romney campaign. And so there's a feeling that, you know, let's think clearly about how we want to portray messages on these issues or how Republicans want to play. And the second is that the record is not that great. Poverty rates are elevated in the post-recession period and have stayed pretty elevated. Now, it's true that various forms of assistance alleviate that poverty and make poverty go down, and you can measure it in different ways and show that material hardship has been lessened by welfare programs. But Republicans really want to talk about what people are earning on their own, what they can achieve and achieve self-sufficiency. And to them, the record of the last 10 years is not so great. And so I think it's both a recognition that Americans do have a state and a stake in programs that help poor Americans, and they want to speak to that. That's what politicians do. And second, that a lot of Americans are struggling and not entering the labor force in the ways that Republicans think would be better.
Yeah, I think that's a very good description of the evolution. I do think it's an evolution since Mitt Romney. But let me get into a little bit of weeds here, which are actually extremely important and came up at the forum. Here I have a somewhat of a factual disagreement with some of the things Robert was just saying. The Speaker Ryan used to say, and this was quoting Reagan, we fought a war on poverty and we lost. Now, folks like me would just immediately run to the blogosphere and whatever outlet I could have, including ones like this, and say that's just substantively completely wrong. And here's the fact that I think is so important. It's a real mistake to look at the official poverty line, and I think Robert agrees with this. His comments just a second ago suggested we're on the same page in terms of the measurement here. You have to look at, and the reason the official rate is so problematic is because it actually fails to include so much of what we've done to actually bring poverty down. And so you can't say our anti-poverty measures, our safety net isn't working based on a metric that doesn't include those inputs. If you look at a measure that does, you will find that going back to the late 60s when the war on poverty began, such measures used to lift about 4% of the poor out of poverty. Now it's about 40% of the poor out of poverty. So by that metric, and I think it's a very solid one, the anti-poverty effectiveness of the safety net has increased tenfold over these years. Now, one other point, and then I'll kick it back to Robert, because I suspect he has a word or two to say.
A few words on this one.
It is, sometimes you look at a trend that's flat, and I agree that the poverty rate even, in fact, especially correctly measured, has been flat for the last few years. And you say, oh, man, flat trend, bummer, I wish it were going down, or if it's a good thing, you wish it were going up. But you have to have what economists call a counterfactual, different way of looking at what would have happened. Well, this is an amazing fact. The poverty rate, appropriately measured, as I think Robert and I both agree, actually hardly rose at all in the deepest recession since the Great Depression. It hasn't come down much since, and that has to do with inequality and the extent to which the recovery hasn't reached the poor enough. But this is a case where a flat trend is a sign of success. Now, we've got a lot more to do in the anti-poverty space. I don't want to say we're done. But the counter-cyclical anti-poverty effectiveness during the worst recession of many of our lifetimes, actually all the people in this room, I'm looking around, was really remarkable and a real testament to how effective it is. And Paul Ryan, we've moved him. He no longer says we fought a war and we lost. Now he says we fought a war and it's a stalemate. Even that is incorrect in my view.
Well, I've got a couple reactions to that. The first is that I think President Johnson, when he launched the war on poverty, did talk about the goal was to have people move up and out of being on assistance. So I'm not sure that the original goal was, or the original intention, was to put people into assistance programs and have that be the difference between their households being in poverty and not being in poverty. What he wanted, and what I think all Americans want, is people to be able to earn their own success and not have to rely on government benefit programs. On the measurement issue, I would just say, you know, I work for Michael Bloomberg. We proposed a new measurement. I've talked for years about the effects of these programs. And I would note that sometimes when the seats were reversed and the other party was in power, there wasn't so much focus on the extent to which the transfer payments were relieving poverty. There was, but the official MEVR shows that they're not, it's getting worse. So, but what I've come to the conclusion of is that you have to look both at the official measure? What are the surveys show people are saying they are earning on their own, and at the measure that says how does the transfer payments work and are they properly targeted and what are they doing to alleviate poverty in single parent households or seniors or other demographics? I think you need to look at the whole picture. And I would also point out that, you know, people have been talking about the mismeasurement of the poverty. Nick Eberstadt at AEI wrote an important book about this years ago. And then finally, I do want to say a word for the long-term bipartisan nature of poverty alleviating efforts. You know, the world did not begin with Mitt Romney 4 years ago. And Republican involvement in issues to help low-income Americans is longstanding. And Paul Ryan isn't reversing a longstanding trend. He's bringing, I think, back to positions that other Republicans have taken, such as Jack Kemp, and said, listen, this is where our real heart is. We are concerned about outcomes for struggling Americans, and we have ideas that may help people achieve self-sufficiency in greater numbers than what is happening now.
So, yeah, let me just say on that last point, you know, it was Ronald Reagan who called the Earned Income Tax Credit one of the best anti-poverty programs we have, something I strongly agree with.
Glad to see that Jared came up with a better example than I did.
Yeah, that is people like me love that quote.
And we're finding some consensus early in today's program.
Senator Long was the originator of the EITC.
But let me take it up to the present. Paul Ryan, people may not know this, Paul Ryan and President Barack Obama agree on expanding an aspect of the Earned Income Tax Credit to childless adults. And I believe he emphasized that at the forum. He certainly did along with Senator Scott beforehand. So I take that point and amplify it. Just a quick point on the measurement, and we don't want to spend the whole time down in the weeds. Look, I think you have to be careful, Robert, not to move the goalposts too much in the following sense. There is a claim made, and we heard it at the forum, that we've fought a war on poverty and it's just been drawn to a stalemate. There's a claim made by some of the candidates at the forum who said that actually is too kind. Some of them thought we've done much worse than that. So I do think that the points that I was making about the increased effectiveness of the safety net, which, by the way, in no small part has to do with things like the Earned Income Tax Credit, which, as we've said, has bipartisan support, pro-work, by the way, something that is important to, I think, both of us here, I think the recognition of those gains is really important. I think you make an important point about up and out of assistance. The idea that we don't want a safety net that is simply a function of kind of boosting people's consumption today. We like to think more about investing in people in the future. What's fascinating is that there is now a growing body of literature that shows that, in fact, many of our safety net programs have exactly that function. One of my favorite examples comes from the food stamp program, because when this program, now called SNAP, began, it started in different states at different times. So that meant that researchers could go back and have this kind of quasi-experimental design. It could also, since it started back 40 years ago, you can actually track people into adulthood. And what we have found is that the difference between people who got that nutritional support when they were kids followed them into adulthood. So they had better health care outcomes, lower obesity, better earnings, better educational outcomes. So it's a mistake to critique the same thing with the EITC, by the way. It's for kids who grew up in families that got it versus kids who didn't. So it's a mistake to critique the safety net. And this was, a problem at the forum. Lots of the folks there made this mistake to suggest that the safety net simply gives you a fish. In fact, in many ways, it teaches folks to fish.
So I want to jump in, and I'll give you an opportunity to respond, because I want to make sure that we throw in some more topics that weren't covered at the forum that might be important to bring up.
Can I just say one thing?
Sure.
And that is I think the opinions and attitudes of the people who are in need and who are recipients of these programs, I think they look at it based on ability to move up. And what are the rates of moving into middle class and escaping poverty status? And to them, rhetoric like the Republicans used about we fought a war on poverty and we haven't made much progress sounds pretty true.
And actually, this might lead into the question that I do have. So noticeably absent from the conversation at the forum was any discussion of the minimum wage. And you both talked about the safety net playing a role in shoring up wages. But the minimum wage that we have now is nowhere near what it was able to do in the 60s, where it was able, you were able to support a family of three on a minimum wage. But, you know, today, millions of Americans who are working minimum wage jobs have to turn to public assistance. You mentioned SNAP just a moment ago. You know, we did a study where we found that if we were to boost the minimum wage, that would save us billions in SNAP benefits because people would be able to have work that pays. So can we have a conversation about poverty if we don't discuss the minimum wage?
Well, it came up very briefly. Senator Scott made a reference to the downside impacts of minimum wage increase on disconnected and young men and people at the very fringes of the labor market, and that the extent to which a higher minimum wage makes it harder for employers to hire people that are really struggling or are difficult to hire, someone returning from prison, someone with less than a high school degree. And that's the fundamental problem for Republicans on this issue. They are concerned that the extent to which a minimum wage gets raised, people who need that employment for that first ladder on the rung get left out, and automation will increase, and businesses that were thinking of automating a practice will move more quickly to that. And I think it's a valid point. We had a session at AEI when I first came here from working in New York City on the minimum wage increase, and we had scholars from left and right, and someone said that, you know, a minimum wage increase really isn't an anti-poverty initiative. It's about more than that. Well, I'm focusing on poverty. I focus on people who are really struggling. And young men are most disconnected from the labor force and are not getting the benefits of the sort of work supports and work engagement activities of the TANF program. And I think they would be hurt by an increase in the minimum wage. And that would be bad in our effort to fight poverty.
So I strongly disagree with a lot of what Robert just said. It's interesting, a minute ago Robert said, and I thought this was a good point, let's ask the poor themselves what they think. Well, if you ask the very young men he's talking about what they think in terms of raising the minimum wage, they're uniformly for it. The support for raising the minimum wage is extremely widespread, and it's most widespread among low-wage workers. So if you're going to accept poor people's judgments of the poverty state, I think you have to give these guys their props as well.
But you do acknowledge that there's some dislocation.
So that's what I'm going to get into now. So let's talk about the research shows in a second. One other point I want to make. I know that there are Republicans who have the view that Robert said, that they worry about increasing the minimum wage so it'll hurt its intended beneficiaries. But I've been working on this issue for way more years than probably more years than some of the people I'm looking at here have been alive. And I know that there are a lot of opponents to the minimum wage in Congress who are not motivated by the research, by their concerns of any unintended consequences. They're motivated by their funding through the National Retail Association that opposes minimum wage increases because it increases their labor costs and cuts into their profitability. So let's be realistic about that. Now, what does the research show? In fact, the research shows, and you talk about quasi-experiments. We've had so many different minimum wage increases across the country that I would say this is one of the most studied, in many ways, best studied issues out there, because we've been able to compare the impact of a minimum wage increase in place A compared to place B, which is right across the border and didn't have the impact. Both places A and B were affected by the same economy. One had the intervention, one didn't. So that's a very good quasi-experimental design. And what that research shows is that moderate increases in the minimum wage have almost zero effect on employment. Now, I want to say almost because there are studies that find small negative effects, and it's true that some of those small negative effects disproportionately hurt the least advantaged. Some of those studies have small positive effects, which actually help the less advantaged workers. I will say this, and then I'll let you respond, is that when it gets to the folks you were talking about, take the most disadvantaged worker who you envision as being hurt by a minimum wage increase. Say that person is a minority, male, high school dropout. His problem is not the minimum wage, if you ask me. His problem is that he's a high school dropout. And what I would like to do for that worker is to provide him with the skills that he needs in order to have some chance at upward mobility. The idea that I'm going to keep the minimum wage at privation levels for a set of working families who, by the way, are not characterized by the type of person you're suggesting, but are typically people in their 30s, people with well above high school degrees, people working full time, disproportionately women, disproportionately minorities. Those are the folks who depend on this, and that's why it's so important to increase it.
Yeah, I just firmly disagree that it's all good for poor people if we raise the minimum wage. I really worry about the downside effects. I also should point out, just on the comment about business interests, the constituencies that are concerned about minimum wage may, you know, you classify it as kind of a PAC giving entity, but, you know, it's also businesses. It's small businesses that employ people who are really struggling, and they're, to them, an increase in minimum wage is a matter of being in business or out of business. And so I think
that's not what the research shows.
I think that's a legitimate concern that can't be just dismissed. The other thing about the minimum wage argument and the emphasis on minimum wage, because I'm watching it unfold in New York, is that so often people who propose the increase in minimum wage forget the first lesson you just gave us, Jared, which was that we have all these work supports that raise the real effect of work in low-income families, single moms, households that get these various work supports. The real return for work is much higher than the wage itself. And that transfers the cost of that additional resource being provided to that household to all of us and doesn't leave it explicitly and only on the business, which may have to make a choice about whether to hire or not. So I really find it fascinating when we forget that. And then, again, I do agree. There are lots of people who get the minimum wage who are not poor and are not related to this discussion. And that's, you know, them getting, a person whose other household members work and is doing a little part-time work on the side. I'm not so concerned about them. I'm concerned about people who need to have there be a vibrant employment situation and labor market for people at their skill level. And raising minimum wages, as they are considering in New York, to $15 is just preposterous and is going to do great damage to efforts to help people through work support programs like the ones you like.
I think you just need to really spend a little bit more time with some research that I'll be happy to put in front of you. So, for example, I know of no study that shows a correlation between increases in minimum wages and business failures. I know of numerous studies that show the opposite, that correlation is zero. So that's one point. Secondly, I completely take your point on the importance of work supports, and as you suggested, I agree with you and think it's essential. But we can't do this on the back of work supports alone. The minimum wage and the earned income tax credit, for example, are complements. And in fact, and I suspect you know about this work, I think it's really interesting. And again, I'm happy to show you these papers if you haven't seen them. I do think they're important. If we push the EITC, for example, quote, too far, what we'll end up doing is actually subsidizing low-wage employers. And there's some research that this gets a little bit into your point earlier about SNAP and minimum wages interactions. If it's been found that for every dollar we increase the earned income tax credit, maybe 25 cents leaks out as a subsidy to low-wage employers and is not captured by the workers themselves. Now, that doesn't bother me because nothing's perfect. And frankly, 75 cents on the dollar is a great deal. But it does suggest that those two have to be complementary. We can't simply ask taxpayers to subsidize low-wage work because if we push it too far, we'll end up subsidizing low-wage employers instead of low-wage workers.
Can I just make one other point, not so much on the specifics of the issue, because we've clearly made our points on that, but on the dialogue and the discussion. It's wrong to say that all Republicans oppose minimum wage hikes. Senator Santorum has talked about a minimum wage hike. I worked on something called the AEI Brookings Working Group Report on Poverty and Opportunity. That was a collection of conservative and liberal scholars coming together to foster a consensus plan. And there was minimum wage discussion there, an acceptance that the minimum wage could go up a little, not as high as the president's proposed, but that there was an opportunity for improvement there. And, of course, I've worked for Governor Pataki and Mayor Bloomberg where it was an idea that was considered. But I think some of the numbers we're talking about in the dialogue really do pose a risk.
So maybe we could find a number we both like.
Well, that there we go. Right. There we go. But $15, I don't think even you like $15.
I like $15 in certain rarefied places where the price level and the wage level is high with a long phase in, but not for the nation.
And not for Buffalo, New York, I presume.
I haven't looked at Buffalo, not for Mississippi, I'll tell you that.
And Robert Dorr, how do you, to offer a counterexample, since we seem to be paving our way to more consensus here, how do you feel about $12, which is the Murray Scott bill that's out
and
there?
And the president, that's the one the president endorsed.
Right.
That's too high.
12 by 2020, by the
way. That's correct.
Again, I think the downside effects on workers at the margins who are poor are too risky.
Well, so I want to bring in something that you said at the top of the program, Robert Dorr, which I found really interesting, particularly as it pertains to this particular conversation that you guys are having right now. You mentioned that our goal shouldn't be to be getting people on assistance, I'm paraphrasing here, but that we should be focusing on what they can earn on their own. Do you feel that squares with the statement that you made just a minute ago about how we can't focus on minimum wage solely because we need to not forget that there are these work supports that are working overtime to help supplement people's wages?
Well, I think that, you know, there are legs to welfare reform policy or welfare policy that are most effective for struggling families. And in my judgment, the three are a vibrant, strong economy that provides opportunities, work requirements or work emphasis in the caseload, the way the caseload is cared for by the agency. In other words, a referral at least and maybe a requirement at most, as there is in TANF. But some focus, some interest. What's going on? Why are you not working? How can I help you get to work? And then work supports. How do we shore up wages to make them go farther for families given their particular circumstances? All three are important. So my view is they all work together, and you have to be careful about putting too much emphasis on the wage or the minimum wage if that is going to diminish the opportunities. On the other hand, you can't put all of it on work supports, and you also have to have a focus in the agency that cares for people on what's going on with employment, and that will bring us to the SNAP program, a program which I ran in New York City and in New York State. In fact, I think I presided over the largest increase in SNAP in the history of the state. So I know a little bit about it. And it is an important work support for many families. It makes their wages go further. But increasingly, and for some, it has not been that, and they're not reporting earnings on their case when they come in and apply for assistance. And they are able-bodied, they could work, and so far so good. That's the way the program works. It's focused on hunger. But the agency doesn't even try. We don't even make an effort to say, well, how are you surviving on food stamps alone? Why aren't you applying for TANF? What's going on in your household? And I think there needs to be a reconsideration of that transactional relationship. Let me just find a way to quickly get you attached to this benefit program, which is transactional, instead of saying, let me find out what's going on in your household and how I can help you get into work.
I find little to object with a lot of that. And in fact, I want to try to clarify this point that Rebecca was getting at, because I think it's pretty fundamental. And as I listen to you, Robert, I think you and I may be in a similar place, which is interesting in and of itself, although I know there's details we disagree on, as you've heard so far. So let me ask you this pointedly. If someone was a working person, say a working mom with a couple of kids, and she did everything that you wanted her to do and had a job, maybe a full-time job, and yet for her to make ends meet, it meant that she still got an earned income tax credit. It may have even meant that she still got SNAP. Would you be cool with that?
Absolutely. I ran the program that way in New York, and that was the
goal.
So
then let me stop. So then what do you – so when you say up and out of assistance, mm-hmm. you're not really saying, like, up and out of assistance forever, never more. You're saying someone who's doing what I'm describing, they're getting some assistance, but that's fine.
Yes, and that's what I absolutely, and I don't think that contradicts some of what we heard in South Carolina from the Republicans. I think they talked about, as I said in the beginning, the role the government plays, work supports.
It's just an awkward. It's just an awkward phrasing. Like when you say up out of assistance, it sounds one thing, and you say, well, the person I just described is getting food stamps and EITC, maybe some childcare. That's okay.
But so I would, but I would point out to you that I think there's a good chance. Well, I don't. You know, you and I both know the numbers are tricky, and you have to really look at it, but. But a household like you described, full-time work, couple kids, still gets the EITC. I'm not sure they'd still get SNAP. They might, depending on the wages and the number of people in the household. But those, I don't know where they fall on necessarily. In fact, I'm pretty sure that that full-time worker is not going to be classified as poor by the official poverty measure. And yet, I'm still willing to give them assistance. And some assistance, but my point is that they are earning. They would report earnings to survey takers, and those survey takers would say those earnings are sufficient for you to have a higher income than the official poverty measure would say. So and right now, 45 million Americans are reporting that they don't have that sufficient income, and that's a problem.
The official poverty rate is kind of like, to me, almost nonsense and immaterial because it's so badly measured. But the person I'm describing, I think the key point here is that you and I both believe that it's a combination of work and work assistance is necessary to provide families with the ability to make ends meet.
Well, and can I jump in there to add one other detail into the mix? That a theme that was really recurrent at the forum, right, was there was this discussion of what sounded like two separate groups, and it was sort of a binary discussion. There were people who are working, and then there are these people who are on assistance. And that it was in that context that there was a lot of discussion about why we need work requirements or work incentives in assistance programs was to motivate these people who get somewhat painted as though they're sitting on the couch at home, you know, only collecting a quote check, to have an incentive to want to, quote, go to work. That was a theme that was recurrent. I think what we're hearing right now is agreement from both of you that that is not an accurate picture of a lot of who is struggling in America. It is a lot of people who are working but still need assistance to make ends meet because their wages are low. Robert Doerr, do you think that that kind of discussion misses the reality of struggling families in America?
Well, first of all, I want to say that there is the sort of working poor versus non-working poor, and I think what was being expressed at the forum was that we need to do more to get people into work so they can take advantage of these work supports. I think that is the principal objection of Republicans with the current state of conditions. The other thing I would point out, and this happened late in the discussion, and so I don't know if you guys were still tuning in, but there was an interesting dialogue between Bob Woodson, who runs community-based programs, and Arthur Brooks, who is my boss at AEI. And Arthur Brooks said that the key ingredient was employment, and we need to get people in employment. And Bob Woodson said, well, you know, there are other people that are really, really struggling and that are not able to get that first rung, and there needs to be an approach there. And what was interesting was Speaker Ryan was sort of egging Bob Woodson on to describe that side. And here's where we get to the real, a big divide, and that is, are federally run programs that are run from Washington really equipped to address those very struggling families that are falling through the cracks in a way that can help them get to that first rung, to be able to work? The drug addicted, the people that are really in difficulty, returnees from prison, or are community-based or state-based programs better equipped to do that? And would they benefit from greater levers and greater ability to address them? And I think that was an interesting dialogue that took place. I just thought I'd offer.
So this goes to another question we have, and I'll let you respond first, Jared. But you're going into this idea of the opportunity grant. It sounds like that Paul Ryan has proposed before, and which Jared alluded to at the top of the program, which would essentially consolidate several safety net programs into one. The states would get a lump sum of money and be able to address poverty this way, which for many, that sounds like a very innovative approach to let local leaders decide what to do with it. For others, it sounds like you might undermine the specific goals that various programs have, like SNAP will eradicate hunger, TANF is helping families who need income assistance. So are these, you know, proposals consistent with what, you know, Arthur Brooks was calling for that conservatives do, which is declaring peace on the safety net. What was your take about, I guess, the Opportunity Grant emerging as this big solution?
This being Monday, I'm not sure when our piece airs here, but I have a piece in the Washington Post this morning specifically on this topic that I encourage readers to look at. And if you can't find it, go to my blog, jaredbernsteinblog.com, and I tend to link everything there. I think our conversation has taken an important and interesting turn because I'm very much enjoying finding common ground, but I think it's important to find where we're standing on very different grounds. And here's one of them. The advance of the forum, or at least through Robert Doerr's filter, the advance of this forum is kind of where we got to a minute ago, where instead of Republicans, and I know that I'm caricaturing, I know that this is not every Republican, instead of Republicans being like, good luck, you're on your own, you know, if you're poor, it's your fault. That's not what came out of this, certainly, as Robert has explained. There's a role for government and an important role for work support. So if you're going to do that, especially in an economy with a low wage labor market like our own, beset with very high levels of inequality, such that not enough growth reaches the bottom half of the workforce, you're going to need robust work supports, and I think and hope we both agree with that. Here's a problem with the forum and the folks who spoke there, and it gets into the Opportunity Grant issue. The budget that many of the candidates who spoke at the forum and that Paul Ryan himself has budgets he's written himself and budgets that his house has signed in the Congress simply cannot support the kind of safety net that I believe both Robert and I are talking about. When you're talking about cuts in revenues that amount to trillions of dollars in order to give tax cuts to rich people, which, by the way, simply exacerbates this inequality problem, unless you're going to blow up the deficit, you're going to have to cut spending. And we looked at the Center on Budget. We've looked carefully at the implications of the Ryan budget, for example, and found that as many as two-thirds of the cuts come from low-income programs. So it's one thing to talk the talk about the importance of work supports, but it's another to walk the walk in terms of actually paying for them. The problem with the Opportunity Grant, at least as I understand it, and Robert may have different views on this, is that by putting everything into a lump sum, what you described, Tracy, that we call a block grant, it means that these programs, whether it's SNAP or TANF or childcare or housing vouchers, won't be able to respond to increased need. And the thing that I point out in my piece in the Post this morning is that if you track SNAP, something Robert very is familiar with, which is still a federal program and thereby very much responsive to deepening need, as in the Great Recession. SNAP responded very effectively. If you look at TANF, which was block granted in the mid-90s with welfare reform, it hardly responded at all. And to me, it's a great case study of the just, in my view, very horrible damage that you do to the counter-cyclicality of the safety net by moving to this Opportunity Grant idea.
Okay, so I'll take that last point first. In the discussions of the block granting of the various programs, I think most of the major ones that are coming from Republicans do talk about countercyclicality and have in it a built-in addressing so that more dollars would go to states if the economy suffered, which is different than TANF, and which is so I think that charge is worth making, but it also needs to be recognized that it is part of most of the plans that are being discussed in this regard. Chairman Ryan's Opportunity Grant is a test. He wants to test it in some states, and he wants to see how that works.
Test it in your backyard.
I would also say that I've questioned him on this, and I've raised this issue doing it with the SNAP program is a big step. It is a big issue. It's a major program. It has long history. It has a history of making important. Advances for families in hunger and in poverty. But you talked about eradicating hunger. In the wake of the recession, or the very low food security at the household level rose significantly to 5.6%. I've just finished up 18 months on the National Hunger Commission, and it hasn't gone back down despite very significant increases in food stamp benefits. And so I do think there's room for improvement here, and maybe a different approach is worth considering. So I'm not so quick out of the gate to say Opportunity Grant, not countercyclical, just like TANF, therefore bad. There is countercyclical aspects to it, and I'd like to see how it could work out and play out. And I don't think SNAP's record on hunger is all perfect. It's done a lot, but I think there are some issues there. The final thing about the budget, you know, it is true at the panel discussion, and it's often true in a lot of politicians' discussions of both parties. How you pay for it is often undiscussed, and so this was no different. They didn't really get into the budget discussions. But I would say that I think that the fact that they're talking about it and talking about it in this way indicates that they're recognizing that these are programs that do need funding and they need to be supported. What was left out a lot in the discussion, we didn't talk too much about it, is Medicaid. And whenever we talk about the trillions of dollars of assistance, often people on the right, they're including Medicaid. And I think it's important that your listeners and all listeners understand the huge role that Medicaid plays in that spending. It's five times bigger than everything else. And it is really going to, and healthcare spending generally by the government, is going to make it hard for us to spend on a lot of things. And I think there, what I would like to hear are discussions of how we can do an even better job of controlling Medicaid expenditures so that there are dollars left over for children and poor families. And then the last thing I would say is again, you might have missed this because you were watching volleyball, but Senator Graham came out.
Go United, sorry.
Senator Graham came out and really quite a brave statement about his willingness to work on entitlement reform, his willingness to advocate for ideas that meant that upper middle class and middle class folks might get less from Medicare and from Social Security. And he said there's no way we're going to be able to afford our future unless we're willing to make decisions like that. So that was part of the discussion.
Yeah, a lot of good points to respond to there. I mean, I don't think for this discussion I want to get into the what we should do about entitlements like Social Security and Medicare, only because I think we probably have different views. I actually believe that that if you were to, quote, fix entitlements, particularly Social Security and Medicare, by cutting benefits, you'd actually worsen poverty than increase it. And so that to me is an important but a different discussion. Let me take some of the very important points Robert just raised. My mind is somewhat blown on this countercyclicality of the opportunity grant thing, that I've heard this from other people. The idea is to say, well, it's a block grant, and I say, well, it's not countercyclical. And they say, well, we'll make it countercyclical. So that just drives me a little bit nuts for a number of reasons. Number one is, essentially to me, it says, I know, let's break SNAP, and then we'll fix it. So it's SNAP again. And I just don't know why you'd want to go there. Number two, I don't know what anybody's talking about when they say this, and maybe you do, Robert, and I'm not being snarky. I really would like to understand this better. If you're saying that we'll have the option for Congress to press a button and make something countercyclical, so we're in a recession, it's a block grant, we're going to go to Congress and say, Congress, we really need to increase the opportunity grants because of the recession, I totally don't trust Congress to get that right. That's the beauty of the trigger in these automatic countercyclical reforms. They're called automatic stabilizers for a reason. Why you would make them not automatic and then put back in an automatic piece is just incomprehensible to me. The thing about SNAP caseloads not coming down, that's a great debate that we should have. And that, I spend a lot of time with that in my post piece this morning. I'd be very interested in your response. I think it has a lot more to do, and here I think CBO agrees with me, I think it has a lot more to do with the fact that the recovery is only now starting to reach low-income people, and we're finally starting to see a downturn in SNAP caseloads. They're down 5% since they started turning down a year or so ago. They're still highly elevated, I totally grant you that, but I think that has a lot to do with need. And not anything more problematic than that. If anything, the problem there is that the recovery is not reaching low-income people as quickly as it should. One last point. You said that at the forum, you very, very correctly and honestly, and you're right, this is a problem for politicians on both sides. No one talked about how you pay for it. Well, to me, the problem with the Republicans these days is not how do you pay for it. It's not like you're saying we're going to do something new and we don't know how we're going to raise more revenues. And in fact, they kind of showed us how they're going to do that just about 3 weeks ago, because they extended some very important benefits to the earned income credit and the child tax credit, very important benefits, which I very strongly support, and they didn't pay for it. So that's one way to do it. But it's not just that they're talking about how you're going to pay for new stuff. It's a different point. It's that when you cut taxes $2, $3, $5, $6, $9 trillion, those numbers, I'm not making them up. They are from the candidates' tax plans. And you say you're not going to explode the deficit. The only way you can make that work is by cutting the heck out of spending. And where does that spending tend to fall? Well, if you look at the Ryan budget itself, 2/3 of it falls on low-income people's programs. So it's not just how you're going to pay for something new. It's how you're going to pay for what we're doing.
I'll respond to a couple of those. The one about, you know, what just happened at the end of 2015. It wasn't just a Republican exercise.
I agree.
It was a bipartisan exercise, and the president signed
it. Important point.
And so, to say that the Republicans are guilty of going ahead with additional spending and not finding a way to pay for it, and not Democrats as well, I think is a little unfair.
No, I take your point there.
The second is on the SNAP caseloads. You know, I worked in the food stamp program for a long time, and I've tracked food stamp caseloads carefully, and. There is a lag when the economy improves and SNAP caseloads come down. But this lag in this recovery is a lot longer than previous lags. Something is different is going on. And I think there are probably two things going on that are different. The first thing is the recovery is weak. That's true. It's a pretty weak recovery, which is too bad and not helping poor people. And second, the food stamp program is different. We have put in, under President Bush and President Obama and at the state level, a lot of changes in the program that make both receiving SNAP and being able to stay on SNAP for longer periods easier and simpler. And we have not done as much on work engagement or work activities. And I think that's contributing as well. I think that it's a different program than it used to be, and therefore people stay on longer. And even though the unemployment rate is now at 5%, they're either people are being able to put together a variety of benefits that make them compare that to low-wage work and say, you know what, this isn't that much different or not much better or worse, so I think I'll hold out a little longer for employment. And I think that ultimately for that family and for the long-term prospects of our country may not be so good, because I think, as Bob Greenstein said in the blog he put out about the discussion, it is true poor families are always better off when they're working.
Well, I think the improvements, I'm not sure you'd agree with that word. I think that the SNAP program has undergone important improvements such that more eligibles are getting SNAP. So you have to be very mindful of what, and Robert, I'm very interested in Robert's response to this.
Robert is pantomiming with his hands a large expansion.
No, longer periods.
Longer periods, yeah.
It's research periods have been extended, okay. The documentation requirements are less, asset tests have gone away. It's a friendlier program.
Yeah, and so you have to distinguish.
Work incentives are not as great.
You have to distinguish, in my view, between whether more people who are eligible for food stamps are getting food stamps, or people who shouldn't be getting food stamps are getting food stamps. And my understanding is that it's far more the former, and that there's no evidence that the latter is problematic. You'll have a chance to respond. So hold that thought. It is the case, according to the food stamp experts I talk to where I work at the Center on Budget, while the participation rates have very significantly increased and stayed high, I completely agree with you, the lion's share of the increase in individuals who are adult and able-bodied are workers. So that the increase in eligibility is largely, the increase in participation is largely among eligibles and largely among workers. So again, I don't think now it may be a friendlier program, and I suspect you would know that on a more granular way than I ever would. And I think that's good, because we're actually talking about giving nutritional support to people whose incomes on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis are below 130% of the poverty line, which is bupkis, as my grandma would say. And so the fact when I see SNAP caseloads going up in a recession, in a deep recession, as sharply as they did, I said, I say, something good is happening. This is working. This is a counter-cyclical safety net program that's working. When I see them stay high, when I know that the recovery isn't reaching poor people, if you actually look at the correlation between SNAP and poverty, as opposed to unemployment, which I think is actually increasingly uncorrelated with well-being and poverty, you'll see that that correlation has stayed high.
Well, and you're back to the official measure there.
No, I'm talking about an adjusted measure.
Yeah.
So a big piece of what we're talking about, and then I know we want to move on to one last topic in the remaining few minutes that we have, but just to call a spade here, a big piece of what you guys are talking about here has to do with a very timely debate that is happening in a number of states right now, which is that states are having to decide whether or not to put work requirements or work participation requirements back into SNAP as the recovery has continued in a way that pertains to people who are often called able-bodied adults without dependents. I feel like it sounds like aliens, yeah. But ABODs, right? Yeah. This is what we're talking about. And the discussion on the left tends to be, making somebody hungrier isn't going to help them find a job any faster. Robert, it sounds like you don't agree with that.
Well, first I want to address the issue about the growth in the SNAP caseload. It is true that the growth has happened in all kinds of households and includes workers. But there, according to the Center on Budget Policy Priorities, the number of people who are reporting no earnings on their case and are able-bodied, not necessarily able-bodied, but are working age and could be working, has gone from about 3 million to 10 million. That's a big increase in people receiving a benefit program who are not working. And that's what I'm concerned about, is the extent to which the SNAP program is addressing those households' needs. ABODs is a subset of that, and the status quo in the food stamp program is that able-bodied adults without dependents, that is, single individuals with no kids in the household who are not disabled, should have a work requirement. That's part of the original Welfare Reform Act that was passed in 1996 and signed by President Clinton. During difficult economic times and during the Obama Recovery Act, that was widely waived because that's part of the built-in response of it. Now, in New York City, we didn't waive it because Mayor Bloomberg felt strongly that there was enough opportunity in our city that we could require people to work in that circumstances. But vast all around the country, it was waived, and people were not put into that work requirement. Now, as the recovery is happening, we're going back to what would be the non-recessionary status of the food stamp program naturally. So the real change is whether we should reverse that, whether we should change the law and not allow the ABOD work requirement to be put into place. I don't know. The administration, I don't know what their position is on that. Mm-hmm. But states are doing that. They're complying with they're no longer offered the waiver, and so they can't take it. Some are offered the waiver still for a variety of circumstances, and they're still asking for it. And others are saying, no, there's enough opportunity for us to take place. I think that I'm comfortable with a work requirement for able-bodied adults without dependents in the food stamp program when we're at 5% unemployment rate.
And another piece of that, before we let Jared respond and then we get into our last topic, another piece of that advocates have raised is that when you dig into the weeds of the work requirement, it's working at a certain level or participating in a job training program. And unfortunately, in a lot of states, people who would love to be participating in those programs aren't able because they aren't guaranteed a slot. And there isn't a lot of funding for those programs. So do you feel that a middle ground here might be to ensure that people who are willing and interested in participating in those kinds of job training programs to fulfill those work requirements, should they be guaranteed those slots?
Well, I don't know about guaranteed. I do believe in referrals to job training and job attachment programs, work search requirements. And I believe that people in need of assistance sometimes need that assistance. And so I'm not one of those Republicans who thinks all government activity or efforts by government bureaucrats is bad. I was a bureaucrat, so I'm comfortable with that. I think we have to be careful about mandating from the federal government, there must be a one-for-one slot ratio, because I'm not so sure that'll necessarily work. But The fact of the matter is that our programs need to be sending a message that work is really important and that people need to be moving toward work or engaging in activities that looks like work, the same schedule, the same discipline. And I believe that in the past 10 or 12 years, the food stamp program has moved very far from that and needs to be implying some work effort. And I should say the Obama administration has opened a sort of a center of excellence on employment in the SNAP program, which it hadn't had before.
So there are a number of pieces of that that I'd like to respond to, some of which I'm in at least partial agreement and some of which not. First of all, interestingly, you're talking about the, you have to, you know, stay too down in this weeds about these adults who are typically childless adults, unemployed, and are allowed to be on SNAP for 3 months out of every 3 years. Well, because of the situation that Robert just described and that the waivers that were allowing these adults to be on SNAP when the jobs weren't there, more than 3 months every 3 years, because those waivers are about to end in so many states, it's expected that that this year the SNAP caseloads are going to come down by something between 500,000 and 1,000,000. So if you're one of these people who's going around worrying about why the SNAP caseloads are too elevated, which I think Robert is, and I'm not, I guess you're going to feel better next year when all these folks lose their SNAP. I feel bad about it. I actually think that these are very poor people who need nutritional assistance. Now, on the jobs thing, the work thing, I know it's very important. The work requirement is really I know that's a huge issue for Robert. And I think that there's a problem in the way you talk about it, at least to my ears. You seem very confident, very comfortable, very deeply clear that mandating a work requirement is a good idea. Yet mandating a job or mandating a slot where someone can get the training they're required to, you get squeamish. So your mandate squeamishness seems to me to be kind of selective. And if you're going, I don't believe we need work requirements in SNAP, but if you're going to go there, then I wouldn't say, frankly, that you should, well, then you have to require that someone is in a training program. You have to make sure they have a training slot. That should definitely be a part of it, but that's the least of it. I think you have to guarantee them a job. If people have to work, then they have to have a job. And I'm telling you, I mean, you may know a lot about the SNAP program, but I know a ton about the low-wage labor market, including very localized low-wage labor markets. I have visited job deserts in cities in this country where you could do all you want to mandate people to work, and there's very little that they could do. So let me just finish. So if you want to mandate work, then you need to guarantee that a job will be there.
So I think we could probably have a two-hour debate. We're coming to the end of the program, and I'll definitely let you respond first, Robert.
Sure.
But there's been a lot of, I think, common ground that has snuck its way out of the conversation. There's obviously a lot of places where disagree, so I want to thank you in advance for a robust conversation. I would love to hear from you guys on 30 seconds in your closing statements of sorts on where you think that Congress, maybe in particular, can go over the next year. You know, they sent a bill to the president's desk to repeal Obamacare. It seems like their priorities aren't necessarily focused on poverty. So as two people who are very dedicated to poverty, you know, in your closing statements, what do you think we should be doing next?
Well, if you are listening to the Speaker of the House of Representatives, poverty is one of his highest priorities. And so you have to just take that as a fact and for someone who's in this world, a good thing. So I think they are going to focus on this issue in the coming year. And I think they're going to focus on the themes that they care about, which is helping people get into employment at greater rates. So the labor force participation rate, which has dropped in the United States, starts going back up. Affected by some of these programs, helping people get into employment. They're going to talk about family and marriage penalties. We haven't talked about that today, but that's a big theme with them. And they're going to talk about ways to make the programs more effective at the local level. And I expect, because of the speaker's interest, that that will happen. Now, whether it'll get bipartisan support remains to be seen.
And Jared, 30 seconds.
I think that there is a great deal of agreement between partisans on this idea of expanding the EITC for childless adults, and I sure hope that we can get there this year. An area where I think partisans should agree, and it kind of gets to what we were just talking about, is job creation programs. If we want people to work, and I think work is a critical ladder outside of poverty to be complemented with the kinds of work supports we've been talking about, there are areas of this country, there are people whose demographics are such that they have very difficult time finding jobs, even in hot labor markets. So I think a job creation program, direct job creation program, would be a great complement.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Robert Doerr from the American Enterprise Institute, Jared Bernstein from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, thank you so much for coming on for Talk Poverty Radio's discussion.
Thank you.
So much. Thanks very much.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us on Thursdays at 4 p.m. East, 1 p.m. West on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also find us on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. East, 8 a.m. West on the Progressive Voices Network using the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes, and don't forget to leave us a rating. Feel free to pitch us on Twitter via the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org.
See you next week.